tempting regime change. And whatever, however horrific Maduro is, and I do believe he's a dictator who has really eviscerated his people, the idea that you can go into Venezuela, take out the government, and peacefully and initiate any kind of regime change is an absolute fantasy. I mean, this would be like Iraq or Afghanistan or Libya, but in some ways, a lot worse. I mean, you've organized the militaries and paramilitaries, and the country's politics are quite complex. And you have Trump and Rubio and a lot of these, MAGA types just playing with fire in a very real way. And it is dangerous. And we are, I fear, sleepwalking towards catastrophe. I hope Trump pulls back, like with Iran. He did not push it further, but you don't know. And that's the concerning thing now. You're killing people extrajudiciously, and you're talking about throwing out a leader of a country. We did that in Libya. We did it in Iraq. It did not end well, and
We're going to have
this
to
will
leave it
not end
there.
well.
And of course, he's also attacking Colombian boats and killing Colombians as well. Ross Barkin, journalist, author, and columnist for New York Magazine, his latest book, Fascism or Genocide: How a Decade of Political Disorder Broke American Politics. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for Democracy Now!
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the First Unitarian Church. Presenting Targeting Doctors in Gaza, Breaking the Silence at 7 p.m. on Thursday, October 30th. The event will include a vigil for murdered Palestinian healthcare workers, a short film of a doctor's report on Gaza, and more. Event info available at firstunitarianportland.org/events-calendar.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon Secretary of State and an Oregon Congresswoman team up for a town hall, getting lots of questions about ICE and the National Guard coming into the city. A final showdown in the race for New York City mayor. We have a report from KBOO's Josh Salem and an update on Portland's plan for a cleaner and safer Rose City. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 23rd, 2025. Good evening. I'm Minette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. As lawsuits and challenges make their way through the federal court system, Portlanders are watching, waiting, and wondering what will happen with National Guard troops potentially coming to the city and as protests against ICE actions continue. Oregon Congresswoman Maxine Dexter and Oregon Secretary of State Tobias Reed got questions about that at a town hall meeting. Here's part of what Portlanders were asking and how Dexter and Reed responded.
Kristen from Portland, you are with the Congresswoman and Secretary of State.
Hi, I just wanted to ask what Congresswoman Dexter believes that we can do to support our neighbors and immigrant families from these horrific, being detained by ICE, kidnapped, it feels like, and detained by ICE. What does she see that we should do to support them, and what can she recommend?
Thank you so much, Kristen. And I really appreciate that you're asking, as a neighbor and as a community member, what we all can do, because I think that is exactly where I hope everyone will be leaning in as much as they can in the coming weeks and months. There's several things that I hope people are empowered with. Number one, just knowing your rights, knowing people's rights. There are cards that the ACLU and PERC, the Portland Immigration Resource Coalition, have put out that just knowing rights, that you do not have to open the door, that folks can't be taken out of a business or don't have to be admitted into a business if told no against the business owner's will. There's lots of different things people can do, but the fact of the matter right now is that the lawlessness of ICE enforcement is deeply concerning. We tell folks that you can't be taken without a warrant. You can refuse to speak, but then we still see neighbors and people being taken without a warrant, and people, in fact, in Gresham having their homes broken into by ICE agents this last week. So with that, then it becomes community resistance standing in the way. And Congresswoman Delia Ramirez from Chicago and I had a conversation about this last week. In Chicago, they are literally creating rapid response teams in communities where folks are blowing whistles and honking horns to alert their neighbors. They're standing in the way. They are videotaping almost everything that they can, and that is being used in court effectively in Chicago to help protect some folks. So the first thing is knowing what your rights are. And when the law is being followed, that is really helpful and effective. Number two is standing courageously in the place where things are happening and alerting people to it. Calling the PERC line should be something that hopefully every Oregonian can just put PERC into your phone. It is the first call. It's 1-888-622-1510. And PERC is really helping coordinate a lot of response across the state. What they can do is help monitor where they're getting calls from, help mobilize volunteers into the area, make sure that we have as many trained observers present as possible, helping families once they have had folks detained. And then we are working in close partnership with them, as well as with community members who reach out to us, because I, as a congressional member, have the right and guaranteed federal access to facilities to visit people and to advocate for them when privacy releases are shared. We have lots of information for folks that I hope people, it's not your first instinct to call your congresswoman. I want people to really feel empowered and, in fact, expected, if they can, to call us, so that we can be helpful and just connect people with the resources that they need. The community has been amazing in standing up to ICE with resistance and peace. And Oregon is being seen across the world right now for our absurd response to an absurd enforcement that is lawless and cruel. And so the inflatable costumes and the chicken suit and being present and having dance parties and skating parties in the street is not just to show our joy, which it does, but it's also tactical. It shows our resistance to the absurdity is equal to the absurdity of what's happening right now. But the fact of the matter is also this is very dangerous. And so we are also working with the Attorney General and the governor and the mayor to make sure that we are all coordinating as much as we can to protect our communities, especially now that there's the National Guard potentially coming into our city. And hopefully that won't happen. There is a training in Gresham this weekend. It is Saturday, October 25th from 11 to 1. And there's the PERC website, or you can look for it on social media. It's open for registration, and it would be amazing to have people there so they can help learn tactically what they can do to stand in the way and to help our neighbors. And then the last thing that I'd say is PERC needs volunteers and other support. So if that's something that makes sense to you, I would also look at how to support them and the work they're doing. Mr. Secretary, if you had anything you wanted to add to that.
Congresswoman, I think you covered it really well. I think I would just reiterate and summarize what I heard from you, because there's a lot of good things in what you said. For me, it's a matter of knowing your rights, standing together, and standing peacefully. I don't think nothing good happens if we give them, the administration, the spectacle that they want. And don't forget the most fundamental power we have in this representative democracy, which is to vote. Remember this outrage that we all feel right now, not only in the election that's in front of us in the next couple of weeks, but as we get to May and November of next year, hold on to that and use that as motivation to vote and vote your values and your preferences.
We're going to go to an online question from Robbie, who asks, what is happening with the National Guard?
Right. Robbie, thank you for that. And that is definitely something I started to touch on. But we are in a moment of waiting. The National Guard had a temporary restraining order placed by Judge Immergut that was overturned on appeal by a panel of three judges from the Ninth Circuit. And we are waiting to hear if there will be a consideration of a review by the entire Ninth Circuit of that finding, because the dissenting judge felt that it was egregious and needed to urgently be reevaluated. So no National Guard troops are able to come into Portland at this moment, but that could change within 24 hours or a little bit longer, depending on what happens. So the state, the city of Portland, are clearly challenging the finding, asking for an en banc review, as I think that's how you say it. And then if that is granted, it's an urgent sort of review. Now, I just want to make it really clear that the temporary restraining order also still stands for outside state, outside of Oregon National Guard from coming in. And I haven't heard, and this could change, it was asked that the judge release her temporary restraining order because the Ninth Circuit reversed or overturned her initial temporary restraining order on Oregon National Guard troops. So there could still be a potential of non-Oregon National Guard troops also coming. At this point, it would be most likely to be Oregon National Guard. And if they are allowed into the state, they are our people. They are Oregonians. And their job is to enforce laws, not to be lawless. And I want us just to be really mindful that this is a job that they do regardless of whether or not they agree with the work. As long as it's lawful, it is their obligation. So we want to be peaceful, supportive as much as we can, and I think that should be returned in kind as long as laws are not being followed. It is deeply concerning because I think it's part of an authoritarian arm of militarizing our cities. It is the intent, but Oregon has shown reserve as well as peaceful resistance. And I have to imagine that if we have National Guard leadership that understand that their oath is to uphold the Constitution and to take lawful orders, that they will do that. And I don't want people to feel scared imminently about this. I think the larger action is very concerning. But here in Oregon, we will continue to be pragmatic and really peaceful about how we address this. And we are certainly not going to allow an authoritarian overreach to be effective in our city. And I have every reason to believe that we will fight that and be successful in that. Mr. Secretary, do you have other thoughts or insight?
I do. Thank you, Congresswoman. The first is, like everybody else, I'm really alarmed by this. I'm paying close attention. In fact, I went down there today. I think it's worth remembering that something that most people on this call know, this is, we're talking about one block in a major American city. This is not what the president and his administration are trying to portray. In fact, I think that, as you said, if this does happen, it's really important for us to recognize it for what it is. It's a deliberate attempt to provoke chaos, and we should not give into that. Even as we continue to object, we do that peacefully. The American military is about battlefields, and American cities are not battlefields. The fact that we even have to say that is deeply disturbing. We will continue, the Attorney General, the mayor, the governor, fighting this in court. We're arm in arm with them. And in the meantime, let's not give them the spectacle, the chaos that they are so clearly trying to provoke with this action.
It was Oregon Secretary of State Tobias Reed and Oregon Congresswoman Maxine Dexter at a town hall meeting last night. Meantime, the final New York City mayoral debate was quite the spectacle. Candidates may have spent more time mudslinging than talking about their qualifications or why they should be elected. That's according to KBOO's Josh Salem. He tells us more.
The final debate among New York City mayoral candidates took place last night, and it was ugly. State Representative Zoran Mamdani was attacked over his lack of experience and strong pro-Palestinian positions. Former talk show host and Republican Curtis Sliwa criticized his opponents for mudslinging and then piled on himself. And disgraced former Governor Andrew Cuomo had to defend himself against the extensive investigations into sexual harassment allegations that forced him to resign in 2021. Mamdani, the frontrunner, suggested he would try to focus on his vision for New York, but he descended into mudslinging as well. He appeared to try to create viral social media moments and even invited one of Cuomo's accusers to appear in the audience. Cuomo, who is running as an independent after losing the Democratic primary to Mamdani, did try to showcase his political experience. He previously urged Sliwa to drop out of the race to avoid splitting the anti-Mamdani vote, but he did not bring up that request during the debate. He suggested Mamdani, a 34-year-old Democratic socialist, is out of his league, lacking merit and the qualifications to run the nation's largest city. He also mentioned Donald Trump's threats to take over NYC if Mamdani wins. Mamdani countered, saying Cuomo and Sliwa, quote, speak only in the past because that is all they know. He added Cuomo is, quote, a desperate man, lashing out because he knows that the one thing he cares about, power, is slipping away from him, end quote. Sliwa accused both men of, quote, fighting like kids in a schoolyard. Then he said, quote, Zoran, your resume could fit on a cocktail napkin, and Andrew, your failures could fill a public school library in New York City. The race itself has been dominated by questions about the Israel-Hamas war and Donald Trump. During the debate, candidates were also asked for specifics on crime, the subways, and the Rikers Island jail complex. Mamdani said as mayor he would ask New York City's police commissioner, Jessica Tisch, to remain in her post. He was deeply critical of the city's police in the past, but appears to be trying to moderate his most contentious positions. All three candidates insisted they would be the most adept at handling Donald Trump. Cuomo spoke repeatedly about how he had held off Trump during the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic and said a Mamdani win would be a dream for the nation's leader. Mamdani tried to depict Cuomo as Trump's puppet and as being too aligned with the president. Mamdani said of Trump, quote, he wants Andrew Cuomo to be the mayor, not because it will be good for New Yorkers, but because it will be good for him. Sliwa warned both opponents were taking the wrong approach by antagonizing the president. He said, quote, you can't beat Trump. Cuomo appeared unable to distance himself from the allegations that forced his resignation. Mamdani said one of the women who had accused Cuomo of sexual harassment, his former aide Charlotte Bennett, was in the audience. Trump used a similar strategy in 2016 when he appeared at a debate with accusers of Democratic rival Hillary Clinton's husband, former President Bill Clinton. The candidates noted at the start of the debate that New Yorkers would probably rather be watching the Knicks opening basketball game, which tipped off at the same time. Cuomo made it to the second half and was photographed sitting next to incumbent mayor Eric Adams. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley stepped off the Senate floor after speaking for almost 23 hours straight. Merkley urged lawmakers and all Americans to keep standing together to resist what he calls Trump's attempts to tighten his authoritarian grip.
Senator Merkley, how are Americans supposed to trust an administration that seems so focused on giving things to themselves when Americans are worried they won't be able to afford basic necessities like food and health insurance?
Yeah, thank you so much for your question. And you've laid out so many points here about the mismanagement of America's funds. And we could add a few more to them. The craziness of spending more money than it costs to buy a presidential jet to rehab a jet that was given to the president so that he could actually send it on to his personal library after he leaves office. But it is profoundly disturbing, and I appreciate the way you framed it. There's enough money for luxury glitz, for a mega ballroom. I can't even imagine how anything could cost that much to build. I mean, it's going to have an eighth inch of gold on every surface or something. I don't know. But that doesn't serve the American people. That doesn't make one single person in America have better health care or better education or a decent home in a decent community or a better job. Doesn't give equality of opportunity, doesn't tackle any of our environmental issues. It is simply a gross display by a president who has constructed his entire administration on the basis of a theory to govern, which is families lose and billionaires win. Families lose their health care, so there can be massive tax breaks for billionaires. They lose their Medicaid on top of their ACA health care in order to fund massive tax breaks for billionaires. They lose their nutrition assistance to fund tax breaks for billionaires. And then over the next 30 years, their bill runs up $30 trillion in additional debt to fund these breaks for billionaires. Maybe I should say trillionaires now. And you think about how that debt, that additional $30 trillion in debt, how much that will compromise the ability to have future programs of health care and housing and education. The folks in my state are looking at the same thing as the folks in your state. We had last Wednesday the information come out a week ago so people could look on the exchange and see what their policies were going to cost. And we don't have a new comprehensive analysis. The pre-analysis, the projection, was that the average cost would go up not 5% or 10% or 15%, but about 68%. And that's because the premium goes up, the tax credits come down, and you massively more expensive. Now, maybe a lot more, because the average across the country is that premiums payments will go up 114%, more than double. But how do you explain to anyone that you slashed their health care affordability to fund a giveaway of $20 to $40 billion to Argentina, or to fund that new ballroom? That's insane.
Some city councilors got an update today on Portland's plan for a cleaner and safer environment.
My name is Sam Bross. I'm the program manager for the Portland Clean Energy Community Benefits Fund. I'm going to talk about a climate investment plan. This city has been a leader on climate since its very first climate plan, which was the first in the nation in 1991. Now, PSEF we see as the latest innovation in addressing climate, designed to help Portlanders deal with climate change. It does this by investing in projects that reduce emissions over time while also addressing immediate needs of those living on the front lines of our changing climate. The program was approved by Portland voters in November 2018 and was enshrined by the City Council into the city's code, which both set into structure its funding mechanism as well as its underlying structure, which has both the fund itself and then defines clear roles for the Portland Clean Energy Community Benefits Fund Committee. We've been on quite a journey. First, as a program that started with the heart of our work, our community grants work. We focused on community-led climate action. Now, as we grew, we heard increased calls for more transparency, increased calls for accountability, ability to move faster. And so we adapted PSEF and created the climate investment plan as our vehicle for moving forward with it. Examples of this work include things like our transportation wallet for all that we support with PBOT, the Portland e-bike rebate program, our equitable tree canopy program, and some of our earlier work such as Cooling Portland. And our last iteration of change came with the Collaborating for Climate Action funding opportunity that we awarded last December. And so even with this, we've been driving even larger collective impact, and this is where we brought forward more collaborative investments to advance greater equity, climate impact, and long-term resilience. Our climate investment plan. Now, this is our five-year roadmap for our community climate investments. It is our document that is our agreement ultimately between the council and the public and our committee. It establishes transparency, clarity, and accountability for how funds are deployed, providing a structure for the PSEF committee, council, and the public. The CIP is updated annually to ensure that investments remain responsive to community priorities, that it's aligned with program performance, and ultimately accountable to results. These are our seven funding areas: energy efficiency, renewable energy, green infrastructure, transportation, decarbonization, regenerative agriculture, capacity building, climate jobs, workforce, and contractor development, and a catch-all are other greenhouse gas emissions reducing projects. We tie this back to ultimately the focus of the work is ultimately about those that are most impacted by climate change and at the heart of our solutions. And that's important just as we think about the action that we're going to bring before you all ideally in January of next year. The PSEF committee's responsibilities are ultimately to adopt the methodologies to measure, track, and report the effectiveness of the program, adopt our workforce and contractor equity plan. They're also tasked with making recommendations to you all. So the recommendations on the climate investment plan, you all are key deciders in and of the climate investment plan, amendments to the plan, any changes to the city code, as well as authorizing our annual budget and program actions consistent with the adopted climate investment plan. It lays out a five-year implementation horizon, providing structure and predictability for the program and how we invest in climate and community outcomes. The plan was adopted by City Council September 2023 and adopted in December 2024. And we update the plan annually to make sure funding levels and program design stay right-sized, are responsive to program performance, community needs, and available resources.
On today's edition of 2025 Talks, North Carolina redistricting would shrink the influence of Black voters, but Indiana redistricting faces Republican opposition. Trump defends more boat strikes in international waters, and SNAP benefits could be the next victim of the government shutdown.
The government should be of the people, meaning that the representative is of the communities they represent. These maps diminish these communities, my community, and that's wrong.
Marquise Thompson with Democracy NC says new congressional districts drawn by North Carolina Republicans won't keep communities together or let them pick a representative that fits. The map specifically targets the state's first district, competitive but held by a Black Democrat, by reducing the share of Black residents and making it more Republican. Democrats hold almost all statewide offices, but Republicans hold 10 of 14 congressional seats. Indiana Senate Republicans say they don't have the votes to pass a mid-decade redistricting that favors the GOP. That's in spite of White House threats of primary challenges. Arizona Democratic Representative-elect Adelita Grijalva is suing to force Speaker Mike Johnson to swear her in, a month after winning her special election. Grijalva would be the final representative needed to force a debate on releasing evidence about disgraced financier Jeffrey Epstein. President Donald Trump says he may consult Congress on land strikes against alleged drug traffickers in other countries. He says hitting ships in the Caribbean, off Venezuela, and more recently the Pacific, off Colombia, is driving smugglers to go by land.
We will hit them very hard when they come in by land, and they haven't experienced that yet, but now we're totally prepared to do that. We'll probably go back to Congress and explain exactly what we're doing when we come to the land.
The U.S. has conducted 8 separate attacks in international waters, killing more than 30. Without proving drug smuggling, Democrats and some Republicans say that's illegal and might even amount to murder. The White House says new sanctions on Russian oil could bring an end to the Ukraine war. Trump has canceled a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin, but is also not sending long-range cruise missiles to Ukraine. State lawmakers are calling on the Agriculture Department to use emergency funds to pay for food assistance as the shutdown enters its fourth week. The department is warning state agencies that if the shutdown continues, there won't be funds to pay for SNAP benefits. Democratic Virginia State Senator Danica Rome says more than 40 million Americans depend on the program.
Our families who are hungry need certainty. Our families with people who have disabilities need certainty. Our constituents need certainty. That's who we're here to serve.
Ohio lawmakers might tighten the window for mail-in voting, requiring ballots to arrive by when polls close. Supporters say that would mean more consistency and fairness, but opponents say that would have an outsized impact on military personnel overseas. Retired Air Force Tech Sergeant John Matecki says mail delays are common and the military vote could tip a close election.
If you look at a school levy for an area, if you've got 100 folks that are voting absentee ballot military-wise, that could swing whether that passes or gets declined.
More than 200,000 military members voted absentee last year. National Football League Commissioner Roger Goodell said the league won't reconsider Puerto Rican star Bad Bunny as the Super Bowl halftime performer. The selection caused outrage among conservatives who slammed the singer for his opposition to Trump. I'm Simone Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Spirit Lakes Tribal Council declares an emergency due to the shutdown. Trump approves a disaster declaration for victims of a Western Alaska storm, and an Arizona tribe polls members on possible name change. Here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
The Spirit Lake Tribal Council in North Dakota has declared a state of emergency as the federal government shutdown continues. The council declared the emergency this week in response to potential impacts on essential federal programs, including food and heating assistance. If the shutdown continues past October 31st, benefits from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, may be paused starting November 1st. According to a press release, the Spirit Lake Tribe's food distribution program has already seen an increase in families seeking assistance since the start of the fiscal year. The tribe's also concerned about the uncertainty of other programs, including the Women, Infants, and Children, or WIC, and the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or TANF. The tribe's preparing and is encouraging residents to stay up to date on the latest information and contact local resources. President Donald Trump Wednesday approved a request for a federal disaster declaration for the recent devastation caused by the remnants of a typhoon in western Alaska. It wreaked havoc on some of Alaska's most remote communities in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. According to Alaska's congressional delegation, Trump also announced an initial $25 million in disaster relief funding to cover initial recovery expenses as the state conducts damage and cost assessments, which will result in further federal relief funds. The declaration enables agencies, including the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Department of Homeland Security, to deploy additional resources to support recovery and rebuilding efforts. An Arizona tribe is starting to poll its community members about a name change that could shorten or lengthen its name. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more.
The Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian Community is giving its 11,000 members at least seven options to choose from.
Write-in option. Do you have a name you would like to see that is not an option listed?
The tribe has posted audio recordings with explanations both for and against each proposed option on a new website. But no action is supposed to be taken by the tribal council until next year. The new names under consideration are meant to help preserve Otham and Peeposh languages. One option is to leave the name as is. Other alternatives seek to replace the phrase community with nation to reflect the tribe's sovereignty.
Option 3. Salt River Otham Peeposh Nation.
While another variation adds Jervid, the Otham word for land.
Option 5. Onkakimir Otham Chalchalom Peeposh Jervid.
One of its sister four southern tribes, Thana Otham Nation, was once called the Papagos, a derogatory Spanish word linked to temporary beans. The tribe officially changed its name in 1986. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Ho-Chunk Inc. is addressing a labor shortage among young Winnebago tribal members in Nebraska, training them for jobs intended to help close a continuing housing shortage. It's part of the Legacy Learning Program, which passes on skills from one generation to the next. According to program officials, there's a lack of qualified young men in the Winnebago tribe to take the jobs that are needed the most. Ho-Chunk Inc.'s Janelle DeCora says the shortage is especially dire in the construction, carpentry, maintenance, and repair sectors, and adds that the students are learning more than hands-on skills.
Our legacy learning instructors aren't just teaching those entry-level workforce development skills, such as